today on Against the Grain, W.E.B. Du Bois, the influential thinker, author, and agitator who fought tirelessly for the rights of African Americans and other oppressed peoples, he professed a strong allegiance to Stalin and Stalin's USSR. What accounts for this? I'm C.S. Song. Von Raspberry offers an analysis in his book, Race in the Totalitarian Century. The Stanford professor joins me, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. A champion of Stalin and Mao, W.E.B. Du Bois seemed to love the Soviet Union at a time when no one else did. So writes Von Raspberry, who spends part of his book, Race in the Totalitarian Century, examining why Du Bois, a towering figure in the history of African-American, and more broadly, emancipatory thought and politics, why Du Bois would declare his allegiance to Stalin's USSR and even eulogize Stalin when the Soviet leader died in 1953. Du Bois was an historian, sociologist, and author of many books, including The Souls of Black Folk. Von Raspberry, an English professor at Stanford University, writes that Du Bois grounded his fidelity to communism in a belief that emergent countries like the Soviet Union and the post-colonial nations had the right to experiment and the right to fail. The full title of Raspberry's book is Race and the Totalitarian Century, Geopolitics in the Black Literary Imagination. It's published by Harvard University Press. When Von Raspberry joined me recently in studio, I asked him what he saw as the overall project of his book.
Well, this book originates with some basic questions I was posing about African-American and African diaspora literary and political history, principally of the post-Second World War era. And as I began to study this period, I became interested in two stories, one about the rise and fall of what W.E.B. Du Bois called the world color line, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the rise and fall of totalitarianism. And it seemed to me that these two stories meshed in ways that scholars had not explored in great depth. So part of my project began to tease out the ways in which these two narratives were interwoven. And one point of departure for me is the moment after the Second World War when the U.S. government began to recruit African Americans into the anti-communist and broader Cold War struggle. And they often couched these appeals in terms of the U.S. nation state's status as the world's defender of freedom and democracy against totalitarian and fascist threats, both on the ultra-right and ultra-left. But by the end of the Second World War, with the onset of the Cold War, the Soviet Union, after the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, emerged as the world's sole totalitarian threat. So the U.S. government, again, sought to conscript Black Americans into this struggle. And my intuition at the time was that Black Americans and other anti-colonial figures envisioned this opposition between totalitarian slavery and democratic freedom in very different terms. And that acknowledgement, recognition of that point, enabled me to tell a fuller story about how anti-colonial writers and activists were engaged in Cold War geopolitics and the ways in which they reconfigured the dominant terms by which we understood totalitarianism as a political phenomenon in the mid-20th century.
So one of the chapters of your book, Race in the Totalitarian Century, focuses on W.E.B. Du Bois, and in fact, his stance vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, especially in the 1950s. Now, for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Du Bois, can you give us just a bit of background into who the man was?
Sure. Du Bois was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in 1868, and he died in Accra, Ghana in 1963. So he lived a very long life, and he witnessed not only the turn of the 20th century, and before that, the collapse of the Reconstruction era, but then also the First World War, the Second World War, and particularly for my purposes, the onset of desegregation and decolonization globally. He was a prodigious and prolific writer, and he was someone who wrote in virtually all genres. I mean, he wrote poetry and fiction and essays and biographies, you name it. I mean, he was really a capacious intellect, and he was a committed writer, committed to politics. He saw his imagination, his literary imagination, and his art as dedicated to both the freedom struggle for African Americans, but also for oppressed people worldwide. And in the 1950s, the period on which my chapter focuses, he develops a broader commitment to left-wing politics and eventually to communism. And this period turns out to be among the most challenging areas of Du Bois's career. So scholars have written volumes about the books and articles and various texts that he wrote prior to this period, but there seems to be an unwillingness to confront some of these later works that he wrote toward the end of his life when he became, again, by 1961, a card-carrying communist. Part of that difficulty involves the fact that Du Bois championed figures like Mao Zedong in China, as well as Joseph Stalin. He wrote a eulogy that I think to Stalin that I think puzzled a lot of people and wondered what Du Bois was up to politically at that period. I think that the tendency for many is to see someone like Du Bois as a kind of dupe of the Soviet Union, someone who was manipulated by larger forces. Maybe the thinking goes he was enamored of the kind of elite hospitality or conviviality that he and celebrity that he enjoyed in the Soviet sphere and the broader communist bloc. Part of that might be true, but I felt like there was a lot more to the story. So my chapter turns to some of his writings during this period, and I focus on one unpublished manuscript in particular titled Russia and America, which Du Bois composed in 1950.
And before we get there, let's dial it back a few decades. I'm wondering how important for and how inspiring to Du Bois was the Russian Revolution, and what cause did he see that revolution advancing?
Well, Du Bois was astonished by the Bolshevik Revolution, and he saw immense promise in the potential for the emancipation, not only of what he called the darker races, but all working people, people who had been exploited by the capitalist system and by imperialism. But he was not a full-fledged communist. He had studied socialism as a young man in Germany, and later on in the 1930s when he produced his landmark study, Black Reconstruction. And yet, he was not a communist at this period. And what's interesting about Du Bois and his trajectory is that it follows a kind of inverse course in relation to other Black activists of this period. So what maybe some people aren't familiar with is that the Communist Party and the propaganda and the ideological productions that
in the U.S.
emanating from the Soviet sphere were really compelling to many Black Americans, and many prominent African American writers were attracted to the Communist Party to various degrees in the 1920s and 30s. Du Bois was not really one of them. But by the 1950s, most black writers had renounced communism of various stripes. And it was precisely at this point that someone like Du Bois actually realizes that communism was the best hope and a kind of bulwark against the depredations of capitalist exploitation. So that, I think, that trajectory, I think, is distinctive and unusual and really striking for an intellectual so prominent as Du Bois.
And how much of that turn toward communism for Du Bois had to do with what he understood to be how race was viewed and how people of color, like blacks, were treated in the Soviet Union?
That's a great question, and I think that race is absolutely central to understanding Du Bois's turn toward communism. I think that Du Bois saw something that the Soviet Union achieved on an unprecedented scale. From Du Bois's vantage point, the Soviet Union and its satellite states had abolished white supremacy. They had sought to empower colonized peoples worldwide, and they propagated a message of racial inequality, and in a sense, sort of criminalized racism. Now, the story is more complex than that. There were a lot of things that Du Bois was not aware of, but he, after several trips to the Soviet Union, beginning in 1926 and then in 36 and then in the 1940s and 50s, he saw something that was really impressive. So there were aspects of the Soviet Union that impressed him. So he saw the enfranchisement of women, the rise in literacy rates there, the work ethic that he saw demonstrated in the Soviet experiment. But above all, I think that the triumph over racial inequality, or what Du Bois would call the color line, from a putatively white nation, was deeply impressive to Du Bois. And I think that that achievement, as mixed as it was, sufficed to bring Du Bois's political allegiance to the communist sphere. Now, one thing that's interesting about Du Bois's political conversion, if you like, is that unlike other black fellow travelers, and I'm thinking of someone like the Martinican poet and activist Aimé Césaire, Du Bois was relatively silent, as far as I know, on the rise of anti-Semitic practices under Stalin. So by the late 1940s and early 50s, there was a kind of resurgence of a virulent anti-Semitism that punctured the balloon of Soviet egalitarianism and anti-racism. So someone like Césaire called the Soviet Union out on it. You know, he wrote a famous letter to the head of the French Communist Party in which he described this anti-Semitism in the Soviet sphere and how shameful it is, you know. And he had other grievances with the French Communist Party and with the broader Soviet Union, but that was something that the anti-Semitism was something that he brought to the fore. Du Bois was not as vocal about these practices. So he remained a fairly stalwart supporter of the Soviet Union. And I think there were other complex geopolitical reasons for why he maintained that fidelity. And I'm happy to say a little bit more about that in the course of our conversation.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Von Raspberry joins me. He teaches English at Stanford University. And he is the author of a book called Race and the Totalitarian Century. And that book received the American Political Science Association's 2017 Ralph Bunche Award, given annually for the best scholarly work in political science on ethnic and cultural pluralism. And among other things, that book discusses W.E.B. Du Bois and his stance vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, especially in the 1950s. You write that Du Bois chose an approach different from that used by liberal anti-totalitarianism. And by liberal, you don't mean liberal versus conservative. You mean kind of the liberal worldview. What were the basic features of liberal anti-totalitarianism?
Sure. So after the Second World War and all of the calamities that it unleashed, the genocide and the extermination of European Jewry and other targets of Nazism, the sort of mass destruction of Europe and other theaters of war, all of these things had taught the world a lesson that maybe grand ideological projects, whether communism or fascism, just led to mass destruction. And so liberalism begins to consolidate and maybe reconstitute itself during this period. And the historian Arthur Schlesinger coined a phrase, the vital center. He thought that the best way to calibrate politics in this period was to find a sort of middle ground, a kind of robust liberalism that didn't aim for too much ideologically. And this view, this form of liberalism began to dominate the post-war era. Now, that's not to say that there weren't competing political or ideological initiatives, but what we find in the literary political culture of this period is a kind of movement toward the ideological center. And Du Bois took issue with that ideological shift insofar as it repudiated any other alternatives, more radical alternatives to the liberal consensus, precisely because he didn't see enough political progress on the terrain of civil rights and the full enfranchisement of African Americans and colonized groups worldwide.
In other words, liberal anti-totalitarianism, it focused on the other, the communist sphere, and the shortcomings of those systems and their practices. And Du Bois was what? Like, let's see what the democratic capitalist world, what the West is doing as well?
Yes. And I think that one way that Du Bois addressed the problem of communist repression, and he was aware that it was a problem, he wasn't entirely naive about what was happening in the Soviet bloc. But one way that he rationalized that form of repression was to juxtapose it with the kinds of repression, violence, even mass destruction of Black lives and the lives of other groups of color in the United States and elsewhere who were not accorded the same weight as those who had suffered under Soviet repression. So when Du Bois acknowledged the crimes of Stalin, he would, in the same breath, draw attention to colonial massacres committed by France or by Britain or by the United States. And so what he was adopting was a different kind of political calculus that showed how totalitarianism was not something that belonged out there. It was not, in other words, the ideological other of liberal democracy. In fact, liberal democracies manifested forms of totalitarianism or exercised totalitarian governance when it came to managing minority and racialized populations.
So your emphasis in the chapter that we are discussing today is on Du Bois's conception of failure and experimentation in the communist project. So what role did Du Bois see failure playing or possibly playing in political movements?
Let me just return to one basic point that I raised earlier, which is that Du Bois understood that the Soviet Union was a work in progress. And he would say the same thing about Mao's China, about post-colonial nation states in Africa and Asia. And they had a long way to go, but he felt that they were moving in the right direction. But there were many very difficult questions that I think we've already discussed, you know, with respect to the mass repression committed by Stalin, the various famines that decimated the Soviet Union. And I mean, we can, you know, go on and on about all of the problems associated with the Soviet experiment. And yet, Du Bois believed that an undertaking as unprecedented and as hopeful as the Soviet experiment deserved the right to fail. It was something that he derived, I think, from his travels in the Soviet Union and around the world. And he saw that with the various missteps along the way, there were concrete benchmarks that the Soviet Union had been making. Now, he also believed that in a revolutionary situation, one has the right to make mistakes, to fail, to learn from those mistakes, and to try to do better. And he realized that states like, you know, Ghana in West Africa, which was also embarking on a massive nation state building project, you know, it might have made some errors along the way, but states like Ghana also had the right to fail. They also had the right to make mistakes, because what a lot of these, you know, so-called developing nations had in common was that they were trying to modernize and industrialize in a very rapid scale. And what Du Bois understood was that the Western democracies in Europe and the United States had many centuries to develop democracy and to produce industrialized, modernized nation states. This was not something that happened in the short run, but it happened over centuries, maybe even over millennia, depending on how you write the history of Western democracy. By contrast, however, the Soviet Union didn't really have that kind of time. If it wanted to compete with its Western democratic rivals, if it wanted to stand a chance in the nuclear era, and the same goes for the decolonizing world, they had to modernize at a very rapid pace. They didn't have centuries to do it if they wanted to keep up. And Du Bois understood that point. And because they didn't have the advantage of time, they were going to make massive mistakes along the way. But nonetheless, again, for Du Bois, they had the right to fail if the end goal in mind was a racially egalitarian and economically egalitarian social order. If that could be achieved from Du Bois's perspective, then they deserved the right to experiment and to fail along the way.
What did Harry Hayward, the U.S.-based African-American communist, what did he write about the treatment of blacks and other minorities in the Soviet Union?
Well, that's a great question. Harry Hayward, you know, he's a name that's not particularly well known today, but he was another figure who remained a communist for much of his life, even after most had defected from communism. And he wrote in his autobiography about the impact of the Bolshevik Revolution on him and how after he returned from Europe during the First World War and witnessed the outbreak of riots and really bloody revolts that were quashed by, you know, the state and other and just regular citizens in the years following the First World War. And that experience radicalized Haywood, as it did many other African Americans, because their thinking at the time was, if we support the First World War, which was understood then as a war to end all wars, that their participation would redound to African-American citizenship. You know, they would demonstrate their valor in war and be rewarded after the war. And precisely the opposite happened. And so Haywood actually goes to the Soviet Union, studies there, kind of on a scholarship, and he writes about his experience as a black man in the Soviet Union. And he says that there were very, very few instances of kind of outright racial prejudice that he experienced. And he describes one story, which is really illuminating. He tells of an experience when he and some friends are riding on the subway, and a apparently drunk Russian man says something derogatory about, you know, these sort of black devils in our country. And other Russian onlookers see what's happening, and they mount what is essentially a citizen's arrest. They seize this drunken man, and they insist that they take him to the local police station and that Harry Haywood and his friends report what had happened. And Haywood himself said, you know what, no, it's okay. You know, the drunk guy started to apologize, and he said it was no big deal. And, you know, they wanted to just sort of let it go. But the Soviet citizen said, no, we don't tolerate this sort of thing in our country. We insist that you come and report what happened. And, you know, once they get to the police station, the officer says, you know, this man needs to maybe spend a night in jail. Maybe that'll teach him a lesson. And so by inscribing this story, Haywood is illustrating what a really radically different social order looks like with respect to race. But he's also educating his readers to underscore the difference between how racial violence, even on this scale, what we might call a microaggression or something in today's parlance, is addressed in the Soviet context versus in a kind of more liberal democratic context like in our own country. So he's kind of instructing his readers about the difference and also highlighting what a more punitive approach to racial inequality might look like.
Von Raspberry is his name. He's associate professor of English at Stanford. And we are talking about his book, Race in the Totalitarian Century, Geopolitics in the Black Literary Imagination. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Raspberry about his really interesting book, and specifically about his chapter on W.E.B. Du Bois, the towering figure in African-American history and U.S. history. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Von Raspberry teaches English at Stanford University, and his book out from Harvard University Press is Race in the Totalitarian Century, Geopolitics in the Black Literary Imagination. So, Von, how much or to what extent was Du Bois's willingness to give the USSR some slack, right? The right to fail, the right to experiment, to give the USSR some slack because of its enemies, because of the threats posed by its powerful enemies?
That's a great question. And I think that question returns us to the Second World War. And Du Bois, I think, was willing to credit the Soviet role in defeating Nazism. And he felt like, even though the Soviet Union was part of the Allied powers, he felt like this swift split with the Soviet Union and the other Allied powers, particularly the United States and Great Britain, after the war, signaled that the Western powers were really enemies of the Soviet Union. So the Second World War was a kind of temporary alliance, that there were deep antagonisms that unity during the war had not overcome. And from Du Bois's standpoint, the Soviet Union suffered staggering losses. And, you know, he felt that the Western powers, were trying to undermine the Soviet experiment at every turn.
Yeah, and just to supplement what you're saying, I'm reading from your book, Race in the Totalitarian Century, whereas some 40,000 U.S. military personnel gave their lives in combat against the Axis powers in World War II, the numbers represent about 2% of the casualties amassed by the Soviet Union. The war left some 25 million dead in the USSR, another 25 million homeless, 6 million buildings destroyed, and much of its industrial and agricultural sectors decimated. So you're saying that the Soviet Union's sacrifices weren't, what, kind of acknowledged or appreciated as much as it could have been by the West?
I think so, certainly from Du Bois's standpoint. And I think that, you know, first of all, if we're thinking about the Second World War and Nazism as in some fundamental sense a race war, Du Bois is asking the question, who was the prime agent there in defeating Nazism? Obviously, it was a collective effort. Probably it took all of the resources, human and material, by the Allied powers to defeat Nazism. But at the front lines, it was really the Soviet Union that suffered most in blood and treasure and infrastructure. And, you know, I think that Du Bois felt like the Soviet Union was owed more than that after their sacrifices in the war. But that's not what they got. What happened immediately after the Second World War was the onset of the Cold War and a very abrupt shift in U.S. foreign policy to a policy of anti-communism, a strategy of containment. And I think that Du Bois believed that the Soviet Union and other projects, again, I'm bringing in here the post-colonial nation states that are sort of undergoing processes of decolonization, fronted by radical leaders that the U.S. government was also very skeptical about, that they also sought to contain, not only someone like Kwame Nkrumah, who I invoked earlier, but Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and others. He believed that the United States ought to have, if not join hands with these other nations, at least not interfered with them, not sought to interrupt their historical destiny, wherever it might lead them.
Well, you've talked about how Du Bois felt about race relations as he saw them in the USSR and as he understood the treatment of, for example, blacks in the Soviet Union. What other things did Du Bois, in his four trips to the Soviet Union, see in terms of institutions and initiatives and efforts that he liked and appreciated?
So, again, I would preface what I'm saying is that by acknowledging that Du Bois, as a privileged visitor to the Soviet Union, was shielded from a lot, okay? It's not entirely clear what he saw and didn't see, but I think we can take for granted that he was probably shielded from the worst excesses of the Soviet Union. But what he did see was heavy industrialization that would lay the foundation for a modern society. What he saw were schools that were devoted to students from colonized regions of the world. Someone like Harry Haywood attended the Lenin School. He saw literacy climb in an extraordinary rate of time. And I think, you know, institutionally, I think he saw the absence of color prejudice, although that would look very different, I think, in the Soviet Union than it might look in, say, Britain or the United States or France. But I think those are some of the principal things that Du Bois saw institutionally that really impressed him. And he also mentions at several points throughout his manuscript, Russia and America, the tremendous work ethic. You know, he was impressed by the enthusiasm of ordinary Soviet citizens to usher this new social order into being. Now, he probably was mistaken about exactly what that enthusiasm looked like and what labor looked like in the Soviet Union. But what he did see was a kind of zeal and a work ethic that was not aimed at personal enrichment or profits, but the erection of an egalitarian or classless social order.
You bring up in this book the stance that the philosopher and critic Slavoj Žižek has taken, specifically on the notion that Stalin systematically pursued a plan of mass murder. What did Žižek say about that?
Well, I'm not responding to that particular aspect of Žižek's writings, but I am responding to what he has had to say about totalitarianism. And he, along with other left-wing philosophers, and I'm thinking about Alain Badiou in particular, have tended to dismiss totalitarianism tout court. For them, it's an intellectually weak notion that the liberal capitalist world, and specifically, I think, U.S. officials, have propagated to squelch radical initiative, particularly after the Second World War. So for Žižek, anytime someone invokes totalitarianism, they do so in order to buttress the capitalist order and prevent any thinking or organizing around alternatives to that order. And I think Žižek's right about that point, actually, for the most part. But I disagree that there's no such thing, I think, as totalitarianism. He seems to just want to dismiss it totally. I don't think that anytime one invokes totalitarianism, it's necessarily doing the ideological work that he suggests it does. My thinking about totalitarianism is something different. So I agree that it has historically been used as a kind of Cold War ideological tool over the last several decades. But I happen to believe that there is something like a totalitarian experience, but it's one that is not restricted to communist or fascist regimes. I see it as a kind of tendency, a repressive tendency that can take root on many soils, including in democratic countries. So I think of it less as a regime than as a political, ideological tendency with repressive consequences that can encroach on or into political regimes across the ideological spectrum.
The voice of Von Raspberry. He's associate professor of English at Stanford University. His book is Race and the Totalitarian Century. There's a very interesting question among many interesting questions you pose in your book, which is actually a corollary as you present it, to the question, why did Du Bois love the Soviet Union, which is, why did the Soviet Union love black people, and specifically blacks in the U.S.? And this, you know, the standard reasoning behind that is that, well, the Soviets, right, they're in the standoff against the U.S. and the West, but if we just take the U.S., there's all this anti-black persecution in the U.S., so the Soviets say, well, yeah, you're claiming to occupy the moral high ground, but in fact, look at what you're doing to African Americans, especially in the South. And so that's a way of really, it's a way of doing maybe a few things. One is maybe provoking instability within the U.S. It's maybe a way to get newly liberated nations from colonialism to side with the Soviet sphere in the Cold War. Does that satisfy you as the reason why, and maybe you could talk about this, why the Soviet Union had a very vigorous kind of research and policy apparatus around blacks and the black condition?
I think it is true that there were strategic geopolitical reasons why the Soviet Union took such an interest in domestic race relations, or what was called the Negro problem at the time. So it is true that the existence of anti-black racism was one way that the Soviet Union could kind of destabilize things in the United States. And also they were able to use that for propaganda purposes. Again, remember, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union is trying to recruit the decolonizing nations of Asia and Africa to the Soviet sphere. One way to do that is to highlight the existence of Jim Crow segregation in the United States. So the thinking is, we know that the United States is trying to bring you into its ideological fold, but look at what they're doing to black people. Now, those are good reasons why the Soviet Union would seize on every opportunity to highlight domestic racism in the United States. That said, I'm not entirely persuaded by that explanation. And I'm not an expert in Soviet history, so someone could probably teach me more about this subject. But it seemed to me that we need more to explain the depth and the scope of the Soviet interest in the Negro problem. The Soviet Union had a whole research apparatus and a whole propaganda apparatus devoted to precisely this problem. Why? I mean, it seemed like the expenditure and the investment in this particular racial problem maybe outweighed the geopolitical benefits. I could be wrong about that, but I was wondering, how do we understand that better?
And what clues have you found? You're a literary scholar, so what clues have you found to maybe shine a light on an answer that makes more sense or that fills out the picture?
Well, thank you for bringing the literary into the discussion, because I am a literary scholar, and one particular text helped me to understand it a little bit better. And I was very fortunate to have gotten my hands on a recently published novel by the prominent novelist Claude McKay, who wrote an unpublished novel, Amiable with Big Teeth, that was languishing in an archive for many years and was only recently discovered by two scholars from Columbia University. And they produced this wonderful new edited version of this text, if your readers are interested. But here, this novel centers on the mid-1930s and the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, which provoked African Americans and other Africans in the diaspora to rally to Ethiopia's defense. And the Italian invasion of Ethiopia forms the historical backdrop for this novel, which is really about the interest in black affairs demonstrated by the Communist Party and what that's really about. You know, I think McKay is puzzling himself about why the Soviet Union is so ardently invested in this problem. So he has a character, a very mysterious communist, who is pitted against a Black American character who is the head of what's called the Hands to Ethiopia, an organization, you know, devoted to helping Ethiopians resist the fascist occupation of, by Italy. And there's a moment in the novel where this one character is just dumbfounded by what exactly is in it for the communists. He couldn't see what having the allegiance of Black people in Harlem and elsewhere would mean to the success of international communism. And so I guess what I use this moment in McKay's novel to highlight what seems to me to be a kind of asymmetrical relationship here that suggests something deeper about the communist commitment to racial equality. That, in other words, it wasn't just, it must not have been just a strategic imperative for the communists. There had to be something more to it. And McKay's novel helps me to understand what that might have been about. And it's, I still don't really understand it, you know, but I was really struck by McKay's treatment of it, because I think that McKay was getting at, and now, by the way, McKay himself was a kind of ardent anti-communist himself, but nonetheless, he was able to identify something really profound in the relationship between the broader communist international and African Americans and other Blacks in the diaspora. And I think that what he identified in that novel and dramatized in a really powerful way is precisely what Du Bois was holding on to. He saw something more than just a geopolitical or strategic calculation by the Soviets.
So all along in this conversation, the assumption has been, and really the assumption is in large part just sort of in, you know, the broader world out there, that Russians are white, right? So Russians are white, and they've somehow, at least in Du Bois's opinion, rejected white supremacy, and so they're going to treat Blacks in Russia in a very favorable way, or at least in an equal way. You write, or you remind us, that some U.S. officials saw Russian people as, in fact, not white. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, I refer to George Kennan's famous document, The Sources of Soviet Conduct, in which he refers to the ethnicity of Russians as having to do with their politics. So he characterizes them as a kind of semi-Oriental people. And there's a what he calls a kind of Oriental despotism that inflects their politics. And this view, I think, was, you know, I don't know how widely shared it was among, you know, U.S. officials at this time, but I think that many perceived the Soviet, perceived Russians as a kind of quasi-Oriental people who were not quite European, not quite Asian, somewhere in between. But that hybridity, and of course acknowledging that Russia is a tremendously multi-ethnic, multicultural country, nonetheless, that their specific geography and cultural heterogeneity inflected their politics in a negative way. And they associated certain traits like secrecy and a kind of despotism and other aspects that were inimical to the democratic spirit as they understood it. And many African-American writers, and I'm thinking here in particular of Richard Wright, I have a chapter on Wright, and when Richard Wright goes to the Bandung Conference in 1955, now the Bandung Conference was an event that brought together heads of state from various Asian and African countries who were trying to think about the post-colonial future and how they could work together to achieve certain aims in common. And Richard Wright, by this point, is kind of like a roving journalist. He's going to all the hot spots around the world in the 1950s, including Bandung, Indonesia, for this landmark conference. And he develops a kind of questionnaire. You know, he is speaking to the delegates of the conference, but also to ordinary Indonesians. And he asks some of the delegates what they think about Stalin's assertion that Russians are not white people, that essentially that they're a rejection of their rejection of whiteness. And, you know, the respondents offered different opinions. I mean, they didn't seem to think that much of it, at least as Wright records it in his account of that conference in a book titled The Color Curtain. That's his report on the Bandung conference. But the fact that Wright is asking this question suggests, to me at least, that his perception that Soviet Russia acknowledged that it was not a kind of white European country was powerful and important for non-European countries whose thinking was informed by race in ways that they often acknowledged but sometimes didn't understand. And so that's, I think, what Richard Wright was trying to get at by posing this question and again to his interlocutors in Bandung and elsewhere.
That's the voice of Vaughn Raspberry. He's associate professor of English at Stanford. And we've been talking about his book, Race in the Totalitarian Century, Geopolitics in the Black Literary Imagination. Again, it won the American Political Science Association's 2017 Ralph Bunche Award. Vaughn, thanks so much for joining me in studio and for writing this book.
Thank you much, CS, and thank you to your listeners for tuning in. I really enjoyed it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.